Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Mom and Dad Are Fighting, Slate's parenting podcast for Monday, April 3rd, the gender-affirming care for kids edition. I'm Zach Rosen. I make another show. It's called The Best Advice Show, and I am the dad to Noah, who's 5, and Ami, who's 2. We live in Detroit.
I'm Jamila Lemieux. I'm a writer and contributor to Slate's Care and Feeding parenting column, and I am mom to Naima, who is now 10, and we live in Los Angeles.
And I'm Evan Urquhart. I run a website called Assigned Media, where I monitor and fact-check anti-trans propaganda on the U.S. right. And I live in Charlottesville, and I used to foster teens, but I don't have any kids with me right now.
We're so glad to have you back, Evan. Evan recently penned a clarifying piece for Slate about what to do regarding the unknowns surrounding gender-affirming healthcare for kids. There has been a wave of coverage in places like the New York Times and New York Magazine expressing concern that young people who currently identify as trans may grow out of it and regret more permanent healthcare avenues like hormones or surgery. Evan has been covering these issues for years and is going to explain what is missing from the ongoing debate over access to gender-affirming care. We're also going to do a round of recommendations where we tell you what we're loving right now. Then we'll wrap up the show with a few letters from you. See you back here in a second.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Okay, Evan, I want to start by reading the opening paragraph from your piece called "There Are Two Sides to the Debate on Healthcare for Trans Kids. Here's What You're Missing About One of Them." And that came out on March 8th. We'll link to it in the show notes. It starts, quote, "Here are some things we know about gender-affirming healthcare. We know that the number of young patients being seen by gender clinics has increased, and that the gender balance of these young patients has changed, with more female-assigned youth seeking care. We don't see the same gender imbalance outside of clinics where young people identify as trans in roughly equal numbers, regardless of birth assigned sex. We also know that autism is more common in trans youth than in the broader population." You go on to write that we don't know why these things are true, but there has been this wave of concern from good faith debaters, which is important because there's a bunch of bad faith debaters, people out there who are just trying to ban access for all trans people. But the good faith people are worried that minors are too young to access gender-affirming healthcare because they might regret it down the road. So before we move on to the debate aspect of this, let's get some context. What do we know about the ability to access care and what that care results in right now in 2023?
Yeah, so we know that there aren't a lot of kids in the U.S. who are accessing this care. There's less than 20,000 total children, which it might sound like a large number, but when you think of every child in the U.S., it's a
it's much less than half of
1%. And we kind of know that the amount of trans people is a lot higher than the number of kids accessing care. In almost all cases, there is a lengthy assessment process. It usually takes many months. It involves therapy. It involves meetings with, you know, different providers. And an assessment is made about whether a kid would benefit from different things. Most often, the first step is social transition. So that's just might be using a different name. It might be using a different pronoun. It's often getting a haircut or, you know, having different clothing style. And then for kids who seem to be stable in that social transition, usually for years or at least more than, you know, more than a few months, there's a conversation about whether different medical steps might be right for that particular kid. So one step, if a kid is quite young and transitioned, you know, when they were before puberty, might be puberty blockers, which would just halt the process of puberty to give them more time, to give the family more time and the kids more time to kind of be sure that they want to move on to cross-sex hormones, which for trans youth can make the difference between, you know, really growing up looking like any other person or growing up looking, you know, very different from an adult of the gender that you're a member of, which can be very closely associated with a lot of the discrimination and difficulty that trans people, particularly trans women, I would say, face.
So you've broken down public reactions to this issue into two main camps. There are people that believe that young people, along with their doctors and parents, should be able to make decisions about receiving gender-affirming care and that they should have unfettered access to it. And then there are those people who believe that making this decision at an early point in one's life could lead to regret. Can you talk about the big difference between these two groups and where do most people seem to fall?
One of the differences between these two groups is that one side is concerned that not enough kids are getting a treatment that could really, really help their lives. And, you know, I think a lot of times people talk about suicide rates, which is a very real issue for trans youth and trans people. But I always like to kind of get beyond the just like life and death and talk about homelessness rates, talk about inpatient hospitalizations. So, you know, you have a kid who's suicidal, they're probably going to be sent to an inpatient psych unit. And if you're not able to help the issue that's causing that, they may be sent again. And so then their entire, you know, adolescence could be sort of defined by these hospitalizations as opposed to them being able to get on with their life and be a normal kid. So those are kind of the decisions that these parents and doctors are kind of making. And so on one hand, there are people who think we need to get this treatment that seems to help some or most or many of these kids. We need to make sure more of these kids are able to get this treatment. And then the other side are people who are really worried about what if we give this treatment to some of the wrong kids? Like, what if some of the wrong kids get this treatment and they regret it later? Or even if they don't regret it, because an interesting thing when you look at detransition rates is that a lot of people who detransition don't actually really feel regret. They feel like this was a process, this was a journey I needed to be on, and I don't really regret anything I did, but I'm in a different place now. So those are the kind of two big camps are people who feel like we need to get, you know, get more access and kind of reduce some of these barriers so the kids can benefit, and people who are really worried about the risks.
What do we know about the detransition data? Or what do we have of that? I mean,
yeah, so I think there are a lot of real misconceptions. The first one being one that I already mentioned, which is a lot of people think that detransition is the same thing as regret. So because most of the people who have detransitioned who you see most in the press are kind of associated with a political effort to restrict gender-affirming care. So they kind of find the ones who really feel a lot of regret. And those stories are, you know, are totally real. These are people who have, you know, real emotions about something that they feel went wrong in their life. But for most people who detransition, it doesn't seem like there's that regret feeling as much. A lot of them feel that they were really more non-binary and that they don't really want to be seen as the opposite sex, but they don't necessarily want to be seen as their birth sex either. And then some of them just feel like, well, this was a journey I was on. So the exact number of people who detransition is really difficult to pin down. Surgical regret has been studied a lot more than anything else, and the surgical regret rates are very, very low. Sort of almost suspiciously low. If you look at other kinds of surgery, you'll see a regret rate that's maybe in the 20% is usually considered like, oh, this is a successful surgery. It helps a lot of people. 20% of the people, you know, it didn't work for them, but we feel, you know, like this is good. So for trans people, it's not uncommon to find a 1% or a 1-2% rate of surgical regret, which suggests that maybe there are people who could use this surgery that aren't being let access it because their greatest regret rate is really so unusually low for what we consider a successful medical procedure.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone who detransitions isn't someone who gets surgery. Like trans people, you know, like other people, like surgery is a lot more expensive, a lot more difficult. You know what I mean? So the more invasive an intervention is, the less people access it. So if you're talking about regret from just a social transition, there isn't really numbers on that, but we would imagine that that would be a lot higher. But also, you know, you just changed your haircut, you could just change it back. It's probably not, you know, that big a deal or something people need to be worried about. And then for hormones, I mean, I think the most recent information I've seen had that rate in the maybe 3-4% rate of people who took hormones and then either felt that hormones weren't right for them, but they were perfectly okay with having taken them, or felt that they regretted having taken them.
What is the impact of this debate on professionals that are providing the care?
I think it is really difficult on providers on both sides of the debate. I mean, I think my sympathies are probably a little more with providers who are really trying to get a treatment that they really believe is saving lives and improving lives to young people and are being demonized. They're being accused of, you know, trying to force this on kids, of they're being accused of, you know, a child abuse and all of this terrible stuff. And I think that is, a lot of these people are really committed and really believe in the work that they're doing to help trans youth. And they see young people's lives kind of really turning around, and to be, you know, kind of demonized in this way, I think is really difficult for them. But I also think it's very difficult for professionals who have concerns to feel that the trans community is very angry about that, is very not interested in kind of listening to that, and to feel that they're kind of not able to voice those concerns in a way that isn't taken as very political and very kind of anti-trans.
How long have you been covering this?
Oh, I looked this up recently. I've been writing about trans issues since before I publicly came out as trans for Slate and for other outlets. But I think my first like medical article was 5 or 6 years ago.
And so in that time, have you noticed that healthcare providers are, you know, evolving or just changing their protocols or the ways in which they kind of interact with incoming youth who are possibly interested in some of the interventions?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think my article was really trying to explain the scientific side of the move to do less gatekeeping. And I think
right. When
you talk about less gatekeeping, this isn't give kids hormones on the first visit. That's like a caricature, but it's, you know, maybe they don't need 6 months of therapy, like especially if they've been socially transitioned for quite a long time. It's that kind mm-hmm. of thing where it's like, well, let's look at the individual case and, you know, maybe make a little more room for kids whose parents have been supportive of them from a very young age, who have been kind of stable in their gender identity since they were very young and not kind of have quite as many hoops for a kid like that. Now, I do think that it is an individualized process. So if there is a kid who has a lot of, you know, concurrent psychological difficulties, if their family is very uncomfortable, like there's always going to be things that kind of slow it down.
Evan, at any point while you've been monitoring these conversations or leading them yourself, have you witnessed anybody have a change of heart about this issue?
Oh,
in either direction?
Absolutely have. I mean, I really enjoy talking with people who are kind of scared about this issue, who really do have, you know, reasonable concerns about this issue, because I do think that people, a lot of people don't necessarily believe that the side that I am, you know, closer to, the side that I represent more, the side that's kind of in favor of reducing the gatekeeping a little bit and getting these treatments to more kids, they don't necessarily think that there are people who are really thoughtful and who have really thought through these issues and have really considered their position on that side. It's often really painted as like trans activists are great, but, you know, who are just pushing a position versus kind of scientists who have really thought through the evidence. So I've absolutely talked to, especially, you know, I'm Slate's comment moderator guy, and commenters are a feisty bunch. So I've talked with a lot of people who I think have kind of become, you know, more comfortable. They may still have concerns sometimes, but understanding why parents are making these decisions, why that might be the right decision for, you know, for many youth who end up getting these treatments. You know, I always try to say that trans people don't have anything to fear from journalism or from the truth. It's not about trying to suppress questions or to suppress, you know, any reported aspect of the story. It's just trying to make sure that the full picture is being shown.
Have you had conversations with proponents of the social contagion theory? Like people who think that, well, first maybe describe what that is, and then talk about whatever personal experience you may have or haven't had with these conversations.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I transitioned about 7 years ago, and that was right around when the idea that the social contagion idea is specifically that young people, particularly young people who are female assigned, and they will usually call these teenage girls, are being drawn into diagnoses of gender dysphoria, you know, because they are seeing this in their peers, because they are seeing this online. And the theory kind of makes an analogy to suicidality, which we do know people are more likely to be suicidal if that's kind of normalized in either through media or in their, you know, family or in their friend group. They talk about, you know, things like eating disorders, which are more common in the West. There's this kind of idea of like a culture Brown syndrome. I actually looked it up for the piece, and I think there's a more recent word for that. But, you know, the idea that sometimes psychological problems express themselves in a culture specific way, where kind of an underlying issue is expressed, you know, in a way that's kind of current at the time. And that sounded very reasonable to me when I was first coming out. I mean, I didn't believe it, but I didn't not believe it either. I just thought, yeah, okay, this is something that I've heard about. It could be the case. What I found, you know, over time was that there really isn't any evidence for it. So one of the things that you read from my piece was, you know, the idea that there are many, many more female assigned youth at gender clinics. And that is completely true. But the other thing is that there aren't many, many more female assigned youth who are identifying as transgender. Like if you just ask kids, are you transgender? It's a pretty even split. So, you know, if it was a social contagion that was causing, you know, kids to show up in clinics, you would expect it to also be showing up in who was identifying that way. You wouldn't expect to see, oh, the clinics, there's some process that's getting people into clinics, such as which parents are more comfortable, people who have a child who's more masculine, who is assigned female, or kids who have a boy who's very feminine, you know, which kids are being more forced to suppress themselves versus which kids are more likely to make it into a clinic. It is, I think, a better fit for the data. And, you know, we also talked about detransition rates. So, you know, way back when I was first coming out, there was a very testable hypothesis of this social contagion idea, which is it's going to lead to a huge wave of detransition and regret. And It's been several years now. It's been, you know, over 5 years now, and we have not seen that.
We haven't seen that.
So, you know, I mean, this is, if we're thinking in a scientific way, they put out a theory, that's totally fine. Do we have evidence for it? No. I think, you know, kind of time to move on, at least until some kind of evidence comes. And I'm open to, you know, if there's evidence for it, great. I'm not great, it would be bad, but, you know, I would very much be willing to accept that.
Yeah.
What advice do you have for parents that are attempting to talk to their children about these issues?
Well, do you mean parents of kids who are trans, or parents of kids who are not trans, or parents who aren't sure yet?
I would say all of the above.
So if you are afraid your child might be trans, which I think is one, you know, big place where parents first start thinking about this. Don't catastrophize and assume there's going to be all these medical steps. Just ask your kid, you know, what they're feeling, what they want, you know, be willing to use a different name. I mean, I try and like even just take the language out of it, like call it a nickname. You know what I mean? Your kid can go by a nickname for a couple years and then go back and they're not going to be harmed by that. You don't need to jump to this is their identity. This is the decision for the rest of their life. That's something that kind of becomes clear over time as they try things out and as you see the response. So, you know, is the kid feeling better? Are they doing better? Or is it just always the next thing, or they're always feeling worse? You know what I mean? Or does it just, you know, it's something they try out for a while and then they move on to? I mean, I do think that people, and this is getting into like other parents, I do think that people sort of genuinely see that more kids are kind of experimenting with this, that more kids are having a presentation that's less traditionally masculine or feminine. And sometimes people, I think, genuinely kind of panic that like all of these kids are trans or any kids who does this is are trans. And this is where, like, I wouldn't call it a social contagion, but there's a social effect where norms are evolving that's kind of separate from something that's almost more of a medical condition that, you know, if that's the case for your kid, you'll kind of know, you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. Who are some of your favorite Twitter followers or just authors in general, thought leaders on this topic that our audience might be interested in diving into?
Yeah. So, I mean, Julia Serrano is one of the best on this and many other issues. I really recommend the Trans Safety Network. They do really deep research dives on a lot of these questions. My site is Assigned Media. It's assignedmedia.org. I write a lot about these issues and a lot about fact-checking stories when they are not correct. I think that for parents who are seeking resources for their kids, finding a therapist who is gender-affirming, you know, reaching out to the local resources, mm-hmm. I think people really are afraid that this word gender-affirming means a one-way transition for your kid on day one. And it just means not telling a kid they're lying or telling them they're wrong when they tell you who they are. It doesn't mean kind of picking something and going only in that direction at all.
I think that's a great place to end this for today, but we're going to link to Evan's piece in the show notes. You should definitely read it and follow his work at assignedmedia.org. You can check out all of Evan's coverage on Slate and his important coverage of anti-trans propaganda again at assignedmedia.org. Listeners, if you have a topic you want us to address, you can send us an email at momanddad@slate.com, or better yet, leave us a voicemail at 646-357-9318. That is also where you can send any parenting questions you have. We're going to take another quick break and join you back here for recommendations and a mailbag. We'll be right back after this break.
This podcast is sponsored by Skylight Calendar. Let's be real. Running a household can be exhausting and chaotic. And finding the perfect Mother's Day gift, it's not exactly a no-brainer. Until now. The Skylight Calendar is the best way to organize the family and give everyone, especially mom, some peace of mind to enjoy the things that matter most. The Skylight Calendar is a smart, touchscreen calendar that keeps track of and manages the chores, dinner planning, groceries, and to-dos for the whole family. The Skylight Calendar automatically syncs each family member's digital calendars and displays them all together on one color-coded touchscreen. It even doubles as a digital picture frame so you can finally share all those special moments that are just sitting on your phone. As a limited-time offer for our listeners, get 15% off your purchase of a Skylight calendar when you go to skylightcal.com/easy. That's skylightcal.com/easy. Get 15% off your Mother's Day purchase now at skylightcal.com/easy.
Talking about money can be so hard, especially when the person you're talking to is still learning how to do long division. That's why Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace, is here to help. I'm Bridget, and with my fellow co-host Ryan, we help teach your little ones about complex topics like bankruptcy, climate change, and why there's so much gold at Fort Knox, and so much more. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, it's finally time for recommendations. Jamila, what have you got this week?
I am recommending the Dear Culture podcast with Panama Jackson. It's part of the Griot's network of podcasts. The Griot is an African-American lifestyle website. It's just a great podcast. I was on there. I taped an episode today. I'm excited about Panama. Has been one of my favorite internet people for, gosh, well over a decade at this point, closing in on almost 20 years, which is scary. He's one of the co-founders of Very Smart Brothers, which was an amazing blog for many years. And he's doing this podcast now. It's super cool. It's weekly. They talk about issues impacting Black America. It's funny. It's fun. Check it out wherever you listen to your podcasts or on YouTube.
And to clarify, it's for, not that it's not for kids, but it's an adult
show. This is an adult, yes, adult show.
Yes. Evan, how about you?
So I almost feel like a broken record, but I have got to recommend the Washington Post's set of stories. They did a representative sample of transgender adults. It's, I believe, unique. It's the first survey of transgender people in America that used representative sampling methods. They asked them questions about discrimination. They found some really interesting and kind of unexpected things. I think they have four or five stories about this so far. And it's just been amazing to see one of the, you know, big national newspapers really take a data-driven approach and really invest resources into finding out, you know, who are trans people? What are their lives like? What are they experiencing? So I can't recommend that coverage enough.
We'll definitely link to that in our show notes. And my recommendation is something that I have been doing at breakfast lately. My wife leaves for work early, and so I am the one to make breakfast and make lunch and get the kids off to school. And there was, for a time, I was resistant to letting them watch the iPad during breakfast because I was like, no, I've got to have like a meaningful moment with them before school. They don't need to start their day off like this. But at this point, I'm just like, fuck it. It is making my mornings so much easier to just let them watch TV for 10 minutes while they're eating breakfast. That way I can make lunch. I can, you know, take care of the dog. I can get dressed. Sometimes I can sneak in a quick workout. So I'm ditching the guilt. I am part of the Rebecca Lavoie school of thought that our kids are going to be fine if we give them a little bit of extra screen time. So I don't know if you're in this quandary yourself, parents out there, but yeah, it's making my life so much easier.
My mom had this exact revelation when I was like 12.
What were you watching when you were 12? Eating your cereal.
There was some, like, it was like a kids game show. I don't even remember what it was called anymore, but it was this like kids game show where, like, I don't know, kids answered poll questions, and it wasn't on it wasn't Nickelodeon because we didn't have cable. This is that long ago. But yeah, I just loved it. But my mom was so anti-TV, and then finally it was just like, just watch the TV while you're waiting for the bus. It's fine.
Yeah, it's totally fine. Jamila, I assume you're on my side.
Oh, yeah. We've been doing this for a while. It helps me, you know, Naima can either be on her tablet or watch a little TV for a few minutes while she eats breakfast. That gives me time to make her lunch and pick out her clothes and get us out the door. Much better than when I was a kid. My mom put on the news every morning, like my whole childhood. And I just sat through, you know, a good hour of the news. It was on in the background. It was the soundtrack to me getting ready every day. And it was pretty miserable.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember the Weather Channel. It was just like on in my house in the mornings. Remember when we used to have to watch like the local forecast on the 8th to get our local forecast?
Yeah, you'd have to wait. You'd have to actually wait.
To figure out what you're going to wear to school.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Well, now we're going to wrap up today with a few listener letters from you. Our first one is in response to a question we had about a girl who wanted to convert to Islam, but wanted to start with wearing a headscarf to school and wasn't interested in meeting with faith leaders. Muslim middle schoolers are attending religious education yet. So we got a response that says, I'm a white person who considered converting to Islam for several years during undergrad. Ultimately, I didn't, and I didn't ever feel, quote, ready to wear a headscarf. But I did take the step of dressing more modestly for a while, long sleeves, looser clothes. The Muslim friends I made during that time were extremely welcoming and eager to educate me about their faith. Like Christianity, Islam's theological position is typically quite welcome to converts. But yeah, a headscarf is a pretty bad first step. I definitely think the parent should see what educational and social opportunities are available at their local mosque. I was a bit older, but the Muslim Student Alliance at my college was very helpful to me. Show her that you respect her interests by buying her a Quran and offering her some more modest clothing that isn't specifically Muslim. Another step that can feel meaningful without risking cultural appropriation is looking into resources for learning Arabic. Even just one of the language learning apps is a fine place to get started with that. And I 100% agree. If a kid is engaging in attention-seeking behavior, it likely means that they've got some unmet needs, and you should try to address those rather than just calling out the behavior itself.
Oh, I definitely think that's a good place to start, you know, reading the Quran, taking the time to talk to people who are Muslim, visiting a mosque, educating yourself about the religion. And if she wants to start wearing modest clothing that isn't specifically Muslim, I think that's fine, you know, but I am in full agreement that the headscarf is a terrible place to start.
We also got this lovely letter in response to a question about throwing a backyard birthday when everyone around you is going all out. Hello, longtime listener here, going back to Dan and Allison days. I loved your advice to the mom worrying about having a backyard party for her three-year-old. In fact, my mom and I published a book about this very subject. It's called The Best Buddy's Birthday, The Complete Guide to Homegrown Parties. I think it would be a marvelous resource for any listeners looking to throw this type of simple, sane, inexpensive party for their kids up to age 10. Thank you for being my rock all these years as I navigate parenting my now teenagers. This is great. Thanks for this resource. I'm definitely gonna check it out. I bet you've got some good ideas here.
Thank you for sticking with us all these years.
Yeah, totally. This is really a tour de force in terms of episode variation because we got this letter in response to a question about relationships changing with your dog now that you have a newborn in the house. Hi, the last episode about having a dog with a newborn resonated with me. I have a now two-year-old, but it was tough to bring a newborn home for the first time with two cats and a dog in the house. We were probably overly nervous and protective of our baby initially, but we have figured out a great balance. I wanted to share a couple naptime tips that have worked really great for us. Our dog always barks at neighbors and delivery trucks, so we would do the following to keep her from waking the baby. Put on the radio or a podcast in the living room where the dog is to try to block out outside noise, and always keep the curtains closed so she didn't see passersby. The extra noise was usually enough to keep her from hearing most outside noises. If necessary, we would also lock her in a room at the opposite end of the house during nap time, so if she did bark, it wouldn't wake baby. Now our son sleeps so hard, it hardly even matters if the dog barks a few times. Best of luck, new mom. Those are great tips. I'm actually going to try that next time mommy is napping, because Rumi, our dog, has definitely woken him before. Finally, I want to share one last letter that's in response to curbing a four-year-old's behavior issues. Hi, mom and dad. I wanted to comment on the letter writer's suggestion that parents who use gentle parenting should not implement consequences with their children. I am a developmental psychologist who researches parents' emotional experiences and a mom of two young kids. You did address this during the episode, but I think it's worth repeating. Gentle parenting does not mean no consequences. This is a really problematic story that's being told about gentle parenting, and one that is harmful to kids. Gentle parenting, which is a vague concept that does not have a clear definition or guidelines, is really just about acknowledging and validating children's emotions. This is in line with decades of research on parenting styles and attachment, all of which demonstrate that parenting in a loving and sensitive way, but with firm boundaries, which includes consequences, sets children up for the best success in the long run. It teaches your kids how to deal with real-life things while they are in a safe, loving environment. Go ahead and start that swear jar. On another note, I can't say enough good things about this podcast. I appreciate the honest sharing of your parenting experiences. The fails in particular are my favorite. Being honest about the ways in which parenting is hard and doesn't always go perfectly helps other parents feel seen and reduces the guilt and shame around parenting. Thank you. That was sweet.
Mm-hmm. Great letter.
Yeah, this is an embarrassment of riches. Sincerely, thank you to all of our listeners who wrote in. We love hearing from you and we love sharing your advice. If you have a question, comment, or suggestion for a future show, please send us an email at momanddad@slate.com or leave us a voicemail at 646-357-9318. That's 646-357-9318. We want you to memorize that hotline number. This episode of Mom and Dad Are Fighting is produced by Rosemary Belson and Maura Curry. Alicia Montgomery is the VP of Slate Audio. For Evan Urquhart and Jamila Lemieux, I'm Zach Rosen. Thank you so much for listening.